Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. I'm here today with Emperor Kester. And Emperor Michael Kester, that is. And we have a double feature.
We have two features today.
What are the two films that we're doing today?
We're going to cover Black Dynamite and Hero.
So you know this is a kung fu ass-kicking double feature. That's obvious.
Yeah, that's there.
But I think for our show, these are genres double feature we'll never be ready to cover.
Never be ready, really.
Now, we've mentioned kung fu a couple times. I'm really new to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably mentioned kung fu a couple times.
Yeah.
I know we've talked about blaxploitation on 4 or 5 shows, and we always hint that we'll get to it eventually, and we just never feel ready to do it.
Yeah.
You know, we want to have all of our bases covered. We want to have seen every blaxploitation film known to man, and these are both genres, really, that we need to talk about, and we just got to get our feet wet at some point. We have to take the first step to use 2 foot metaphors in a row. So today's the day. I mean, Black Dynamite is a fairly new blaxploitation film, and so that makes me a little bit more comfortable. And you know what you're talking about with Hero, so
yep.
I feel even more comfortable.
Great.
We're going to spoil both of these films. I'm going to say Hero has more spoilers. Black Dynamite has what you once called the worst kind of spoilers, joke spoilers.
Right.
We are going to talk a lot about the humor of that film, but there's also sort of a twist in Black Dynamite.
Uh-huh.
There's a revelation that happens.
Yeah, I guess that's a good thing to call it.
And so we're going to definitely spoil both films.
Mm-hmm.
We have chapters in the podcast. If you haven't seen either of the movies, you can use the chapters menu to sort of skip around. Skip to Black Dynamite right now, skip to Hero, or skip to the end of the show and find out what riveting films we will be doing on Double Feature the very next episode.
Dynamite!
What you mean is Black Dynamite.
Sorry.
So this is a Scott Saunders film, and I want to mention him right away because I don't think we have to give him a lot of credit. Everything we're going to be talking about is, in part, his work. And he hasn't done a lot before this. You know, he did Thick as Thieves for HBO.
Okay.
And beyond that, fairly new director. I think we'll be spending a lot of this conversation talking about Michael J. White, but we have to start first and just get the blaxploitation thing out of the way. In previous episodes, I believe I've described blaxploitation, and I fumble around a lot when I do it because it's hard to narrow down exactly what it was, especially without being there for the time and place. But we often talk about it as producer, you know, with Leprechaun especially.
Sure.
When we did Leprechaun in the Hood, which is sort of modern, you can't even, blaxploitation doesn't exist anymore.
Modern day blaxploitation isn't really a genre.
Yeah, it's not blaxploitation like we knew it. And to do blaxploitation the way Black Dynamite did is a callback.
Mm-hmm.
So in today's modern era, blaxploitation is gone. And we'll talk about where it went.
Yep.
But at the time I described blaxploitation as films made usually by white producers, or it doesn't even really matter what the color of their skin is, but that they meant to cash in on a black audience. They tried to make a film with their audience in mind before their own filmmaking creativity.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know what, I'm going to make a film for this particular demographic. And they tried to write these scripts that they thought would appeal to black audiences. So this had some mixed results, some really mixed results. And over the decade, there were a lot of mixed reactions from the very audiences they were trying to market to in the first place. Now, attempting to identify a blaxploitation movie is actually a lot easier than trying to describe one. They were essentially all from the 70s, and most of them were riddled with cliches, so you know one if you saw it. After the 70s, they pretty much vanished completely, so they're very much of that time. I mean visibly so.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the decade, I think most people would agree that the subject matter is the key characteristic. They try to exploit ghetto life. They're produced to exploit life on the street. And oftentimes that comes off as a little humorous. And
yeah.
I think that's probably why people still love these films today.
Right.
Is they have
sass.
They do, yes. They have sass. Almost ironic sass at this point. You'll find slurs against whites. You will find the man thrown around. The man is always the enemy, right? Always the antagonist in these films.
Story of my life.
And you might be saying to yourself, okay, that makes sense. You're trying to appeal to an idea that black people feel that the man is keeping them down. But what's funny about blaxploitation is they don't really portray black characters very well either. They're always thugs, they're pimps, They're drug dealers. The protagonists of these films are just as stereotypical as the white antagonists of these films.
Right, absolutely.
So all the characters are completely static.
It's just
and it's,
bad guys.
It's a big joke.
It's all bad guys. Yeah. It's just which bad guy is cooler.
Sure. So if you want to put the race issues aside, the thing I really like about blaxploitation that makes it unlike any other genre, we've covered monster exploitation. We've covered sexploitation.
Roadsploitation.
Roadsploitation is one of our favorites. What's great about blaxploitation is it's not really a genre. It's a genre in as far as you can classify a group of films. But it's not really dramas, action films. I mean, blaxploitation, if you're going to ignore the racial component of it, spans 5 or 6 other genres.
Yeah, absolutely.
You see so many different areas. You have black road films.
Right.
You have black dramas. Well, you have black monster movies.
Black Dynamite is black kung fu.
Yeah, black kung fu film. I mean, and sometimes they get really corny. You have black monster movies. You have Blackula, fucking Blackula. So it covers such a wide variety of genres and with a mixed comedic effect.
It's basically just black people doing what normal people do.
It's funny. You can see a producer sitting in a chair and saying, well, we have the Jewish version of that movie.
Right.
Why don't we make the black
version?
Mel
Brooks made the Jewish version.
Yes.
I don't know what film we're talking about, but Mel Brooks made it.
And it's such a fucking racist idea, but for a while it actually worked. So exploitation was big in the 60s. It was big in the 70s. It was even pretty big in the 80s. You have different forms of exploitation throughout every decade.
Mm-hmm.
Blaxploitation almost exclusively existed in the 70s.
Yep.
And I think that's because, and I described this again back on the Leprechaun show, is at first it was cashing in on the black audience.
Uh-huh.
And black audiences quickly realized that, but they embraced it anyways, almost for the cheesiness factor. You know, from the start with films like Shaft, you had a character who people just loved to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, society turned around on that, partially due to the NAACP. You know, they tried to raise awareness of how stereotypical these movies, not even how stereotypical the movies were. Everyone kind of knew that, but how much damage it was doing to social equality. And the sort of zeitgeist of the time just changed, and people decided, you know what, we've had enough of blaxploitation. The market took over. People said, we're going to stop seeing these films. And they mostly faded out. They mostly disappeared by
pretty
the
much,
end of the
yeah.
70s. One other thing I really like, besides all the different genres you can play in, is that, and part of this is probably because of how many different genres it moved around in, but you have powerful female characters. You have really strong female, almost role models in a lot of these films.
Mm-hmm.
Foxy Brown is always the first one that comes to my mind. Pam Grier did a couple of these.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the, again, to go back, the stereotypical ghetto life idea of overcoming oppression. And what's even more of an exploitative market than black people overcoming oppression is black women. The double minority card is all of these producers. I can just see them just grabbing fistfuls of money in their hand and thinking, what if we used black women? That's even more of the niche we're trying to appeal to.
These guys are really evil in your mind, aren't they?
Yeah, it is. It's very cynical. This entire genre to me is very cynical. And why I love a film like Black Dynamite, that brings a lot of that stuff back, but in a way I think it's just so perfect. Even to think about the strong female archetype, a character like Gloria,
uh-huh.
that we see in the, is really one of the first redeemable characters we see in Black Dynamite,
yeah.
who's fighting politically for things she believes in. You know, she doesn't need a man to come and defend her. She's doing fine at that point. It's her decision to team up with Black Dynamite.
That's right.
So Michael J. White stars in this thing. And along with a couple other people, he wrote the story and he wrote the script for this. The first thing that comes across to me, besides the visuals when I'm watching Black Dynamite, is the language. You know, and that's another really typical part of blaxploitation, is you expect a particular language, the slang, really. It's this really corny, overplayed, beatnik type of slang, which I call corny, but then I will use terms like dig on this show.
And jive turkey. You say jive turkey to no end.
I don't think I say jive turkey a whole lot. I'll have to watch for that one. We get that really, really heavy in the beginning because that's almost what people want. They go there, and if you know one thing about blaxploitation, you know that it's a lot of ridiculous slang. And so they open up with a lot of that, but they don't rely on it. It's not the crutch through the entire film. A couple of these recent blaxploitation throwbacks have been made, and some of them rely to a fault on using this, what's essentially the same joke. It's mm-hmm. a joke mechanism at that point, right?
Sure.
It's not just what you want to see, but when someone says jive turkey, you know, it's a cheap, easy laugh. And you get those out of the way right in the first scene, first and second scene of the movie, and then the film chooses not to rely on the same joke. It chooses to mix things up. part of doing a throwback like this too is that you had a lot of cheap actors in blaxploitation. You had people who weren't doing a very good job. You tried to get a strong lead, and then you just sort of filled in because these films were made on the cheap.
Then that's you would hire black people.
That's part of exploitation.
Absolutely.
Is, yeah, the casting director would sit there and say, we need to fill the frame with more black people.
Right.
Just take any extras you want, throw them in here. It's fine. They don't have to carry anything, except if they had dialogue, it would usually be pretty awful. So the poor dialogue is written, right? We don't count on the performances to do that, although they work here. But you can tell that the poor dialogue is written right into the script. The different delivery, the way words are kind of thrown around in different areas. There's a lot of verbal banter that you can tell comes directly off of the page. So I think it's smart to have that written up front rather than to just bring a pretty good script to the table.
And then hope that magic happens on screen.
Yeah, hope people will butcher it intentionally in the way that, you know, in the way you intended.
It's never good to count on something to happen if you already can make it happen in your mind.
Yeah, the earlier you can accomplish that, the better.
Absolutely.
There's other parts I feel the script is really smart too, when it's not even just commenting on blaxploitation. Look at the scene I was talking about with Gloria earlier, the Congressman James speech. He's talking, you know, she goes up there and she says some really heavy stuff.
Right.
I'm using the slang already, really heavy stuff.
It's all right, man.
But she has a lot of powerful ideas, and then he goes up there, and he says essentially nothing,
but he
says it with slogans.
He rhymes.
Yeah, he says it with slogans that people love, and I don't think that's necessarily part of blaxploitation. It's just something politicians actually do, and it's really sad to see that someone can have these great ideas, but if they can't rhyme, then no one's going to pay attention to them.
They don't have a hook.
Yeah, they need a hook. That's exactly what it is. Without a hook, you're screwed.
Tool jokes.
The other great thing about a lot of these jokes, and we'll talk about this when we get to audio, is that the music almost acts as a laugh track. You know, we've talked about laugh tracks on the show too. They're in place because you have a natural tendency to laugh. You're more likely to laugh if you hear other people laughing. That's why movies are funnier in groups. Maybe not the sick, fucked up movies we watch, but most movies are funnier in groups. So right after someone tells a joke, especially if it's a corny one, what do you get?
Dynamite!
Or a music cue. It's almost as if saying, hey, you could laugh or I'm going to slap you in the face.
Dynamite!
So maybe Michael J. White wrote a great script. That's fine. But he can also punch people.
And yeah, he can.
That works out really well for him, too.
I mean, and by can, you don't mean he is able to. You mean he's trained in the
art. He's a professional martial artist, whatever the fuck that means.
Probably means he teaches people how to punch other people.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
He makes a living punching people.
As a profession.
That's what it is.
Thank you. Thank you for clearing that up.
You're welcome.
So when he's not, you know, playing Spawn in the... I reference Spawn all the time. There's two different Spawns. I usually reference the HBO Spawn when we're talking about Keith David. But the only place I'd seen Michael J. White before was playing Spawn, playing Al Simmons in the actual movie. Do you remember the movie version of Spawn?
Yeah, that I haven't seen the HBO version.
Oh, the HBO. Oh, so you just thought I was always...
Yeah, I just always assumed you were talking about the John Leguizamo version.
Oh, that's a shame.
Oh.
So what I like about the action is that it's part of the jokes. I mean, the pool scene where he's jump kicking the light, the nunchuck, in the same scene, right? The nunchucks that also act like a boomerang that come right back to his hand. Probably my favorite one is when he cuts off the Kung Fu master's arm. I threw that shit before I walked in the room, and I just bust out laughing
every hilarious.
Time. I like using the action not only as sort of eye candy, but also it's part of the jokes. And I think Black Dynamite is a good replication of the original blaxploitation too. You know, none of the look is done in post. It's all Super 16 color reversal film, so which is, you know, the way they did it. It's got an original soundtrack, and the composer, and I thought this was really interesting, the guy who wrote the music is also the editor, which comes back to a lot of that stuff I was saying about the jokes and about almost a laugh track score. You know the rhythm when you're editing things together and where the music needs to go to make that the most effective. The other advantage of having a completely original score like this is that you get to have, it's almost an original soundtrack.
Yeah.
A lot of the songs have lyrics.
Right.
You know, to go back to a lot of the blaxploitation stuff, it used a lot of elements of funk. It had a very distinctive sound to it. So in Black Dynamite, you have songs about what's literally happening on screen. You have songs using the term Black Dynamite. It's always, again, to go back to Shaft. The Shaft theme song is one of the most iconic pieces of blaxploitation.
Well, my favorite song in Black Dynamite easily is Cleaning Up the Streets.
Yeah.
Because you and I throw that term around all the time to make fun of films or to even commend films when when they lose sight of what they're actually doing and it just turns into a hero trying to make the world a better place.
Well, it's amazing how often that happens. Right. You forget what your purpose is, and by the time you get a character in the streets fighting crime, they just keep doing that, because that's a comfortable place to be for about 45 minutes of your
film. And then
they're
cleaning up the streets.
So obviously there's costume, wardrobe stuff, set stuff that all helps replicate the look of the original. But another choice they made, and I'm curious how you feel about this, but I noticed this right away, there's almost no cameos, especially A-list cameos. A blaxploitation film could certainly have a lot of cameos people who originally were involved in that, people who are big fans of that. I'm looking at Samuel L. Jackson. And I know there's budgetary constraints there. Cameos cost money, but they're certainly cheaper than getting a lead. Right. And they just make the decision not to have any.
There's one big scene that has a few minor cameos.
Sure,
and
minor.
It's the scene where it's a bunch of the pimps all around talking about how the game has changed.
Right.
And Arsenio Hall's in there. Brian McKnight is in there. I mean, none of these actors are ex-blaxploitation actors. Right.
But not distracting. I mean, that's my overall point.
They don't become part of the film. They don't become what you look for.
Because that would take you out of the movie. I mean, let's use that example of Samuel Jackson. I use him because he played Shaft in the remake. You know, you're watching this movie and you can almost disappear into thinking this was actually a piece of blaxploitation.
Absolutely.
Which is important when we talk about exploitation, because as much as we're fans of the genre, the subgenres, you know, we're often bored by exploitation as well. So I like the idea that you've got this film almost as if you found it back in a bin of DVDs from the 70s. And if you saw a prominent actor from recent times, it would totally take you out of it.
So a lot of what's going on with the show today is we're kind of touching on how old, perhaps even dead genres of exploitation or old 70s subgenres of film have been brought back in whatever way they may have been brought back in the 2Ks or where are we now, 2010?
Yeah.
And Black Dynamite is this special type of blaxploitation, because we've kind of said, we said it with Leprechaun in the Hood. Friday is another example of what people may believe is new age blaxploitation. Sure. That's not what it is. Blaxploitation has to be set in the 70s. And the thing is, if you just make a film that seems like it's from the 70s, it's only as good as the 70s.
Yeah, that's the problem with a lot of the original exploitation stuff. When we started the show especially, I was just in a big kick of that stuff. And you watch a lot of it and it's long and it's really padded. Even examples that have done this recently, and you get them from all different directions. I mean, Hookers in Revolt, you could probably count Pootie Tang, Jackie Brown. They have their pluses and their minuses, maybe some more minuses, depending on which of the three of those movies you're talking about. But a big problem I have with a lot of genre throwbacks, and not even blaxploitation, but just, you know, exploitation throwback has become another type of genre, especially in recent years. You have to do it better.
Yeah.
You have to expand on it. You can't just say, I was a fan of that. Look, I'm going to do one. And so I feel like Black Dynamite gets that stuff especially right. Stuff we've talked about on the show. Black Dynamite is aware of the stuff that we hate. You know, one of the flashback scenes. Jimmy, I am 18-year-old Black Dynamite. I am your brother. You know, how often do we talk about that? Where poor writing, that thinks it's clever, which is even worse. It's bad enough to be poor writing, but when it goes, hey, look at this little clue I'm giving you. People don't actually, in a conversation between you and I on the street, I wouldn't walk up to you and go, Michael, you are my co-host. Here's something important that, I wouldn't give you that context clue. Black Dynamite goes out of its way right in the beginning to say, I've seen that before. I hate that as much as you do. The other one I love is not the orphanage. I used to be an orphan.
Yeah.
You know, it's this great exposition thing. And then there's other clever ideas that go above exploitation throwback. It's not enough for them to just make another exploitation film. They have to make a good one. You know, you start out thinking that malt liquor is a joke. It's a sort of product placement joke because the film's throwing around a lot of jokes about stupid things that blaxploitation movies do. So you're thinking, all right, malt liquor, Anaconda, it's a big reference to product placement, cashing in films. But then it turns out in what's a really well-written scene, a conspiratorial scene of one of these Da Vinci Code kind of things where you're making leap to leap to leap from clue to clue without any real reason why you would use those clues. And it's revealed that the malt liquor is integral to the plot. It's a plot device. No one saw that coming. It's a fucking plot device. The commercial before the film is not a commercial just to celebrate commercials before films. Oh, really fucking clever. You put a commercial before your film. It's a fucking plot device in the story. The ultimate thing it can do above exploitation is not drag. That's my least favorite part of all exploitation
films. The parts where they drag?
The parts where they...
Well, I don't think you're alone in that.
You want them to be fun, right?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Well, I mean... Okay, so a heady drama that comes out this year. You could disagree with things it does. Maybe it pulls out a sci-fi twist in the end. There's lots of different mistakes a film can make. All exploitation needs to do for us right now, it had a different purpose back then, but right now we just want to be entertained by it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only reason people go back to that stuff.
Well, back in the 70s, the goal of exploitation was never to entertain people. That's the magic of exploitation, well, and that's why it
was to trick people into thinking they would be entertained.
It was to get people to go to the theater. Sure. Once you were at the theater, they could fucking show you a reel of silence.
Yeah.
And as long as you paid for your ticket, they don't care. They'll make a movie called The Flying Vagina That Ate New York. I would pay to see that, even if there was no flying vagina and it didn't eat New York.
And so that's why the films are often padded. No one's going to come back and blog about it. It was the fucking 70s. These were shown in these little bullshit theaters where people went because they wanted to go to a theater. And the poster had a woman in space, and so you went to space. Black Dynamite can't do that. It doesn't want to do that. It's not going to drag. You know, so they create a movie that is short. The action is ridiculously good. It has a lot of variety. You know, they mix it up a lot so you don't get too drugged down in desaturated throwback world. You have the animation stuff for the scene where they're fucking, which is great. Little stuff like the subtitles at the end. They have that misspelled subtitle. Even the locations. You know, you're never in the same location for more than 20 minutes. They keep traveling to different parts and sort of revisiting different subgenres or sub-subgenres of blaxploitation. Do some kung fu stuff, go to the White House. They're all over the place. You can't possibly get bored with this film. Even the end credits. The end credits are probably the most telling. No one's going to fault you for only being entertaining up to the black screen where your end credits roll. But Black Dynamite is made with a lot of love, so they have a great animated sequence over their end credits. They wanted to make this film. They're not cashing in. I think that's what makes this probably the best piece of fucking guilt-free modern-day blaxploitation. Awesome.
All right, so let's move from blaxploitation to a film with literally no black people. I'm sick of black people. Let's get away from them. I'm sorry.
So this is a weird place for me. You know what I feel like as we're watching Hero? I feel like Patricia Arquette's character in True Romance. Like, I started the movie from the beginning, but I still feel like I'm coming in and I'm sitting next to you going, who's the guy in the black? Why is he fighting the other guy? What's happening here?
Yeah, well, a lot of heroes...
It threw me off a little bit. I've never seen a Chinese movie before. I have no idea what's going on.
I've seen a few. I've seen Hero a few times. I mean, I'll come out and say that I chose Hero for this. We decided we wanted to do an exploitation show.
Right.
And we decided that we were going to kind of do a blaxploitation kung fu thing.
Right.
And so I made the call to put Hero in as my new age kung fu experimental thing.
Well, and it's a great choice because it allows us to get away from a conversation about just doing exploitation throwbacks.
Right.
Because Black Dynamite is an exploitation throwback. No one is making that argument for Hero. Hero is an evolution. It's a natural step in what's come before.
Well, and that's because blaxploitation had to die with the 70s.
Yeah.
Everybody was okay with it in the 70s, and that's where it needs to stay.
Yeah.
The thing about Kung Fu is through the years, it went through so many evolutions in that it had to become a different art form in order for it to still be accepted by modern standards.
Can't keep doing more of the same.
Kung Fu in the 70s was very similar to blaxploitation in that it was very highly exploitative of the Eastern elements of fighting. It was it was almost action films.
Yeah.
They were almost action films, with the exception that it was all Kung Fu, and there's about five major Kung Fu actors that would show up in thousands of films.
Sure.
Probably less. But now, in recent times, we've kind of had to evolve into a more artistic view of the exact same elements.
Sure.
Hero is a logical evolution that takes the Eastern culture, it takes Eastern battle techniques, Eastern thought.
Everything Kung Fu's built so far.
Absolutely. And it puts it in a very artistic package that comes out. And it's actually, I mean, it's a lot more moving than a 70s Kung Fu film would ever be. But at the same time, it fulfills the same checklist if you brought it out. Mm. With the exception of it being, it's probably a bigger budget, granted.
Well, we're looking at Hero, which at the time at least was the most expensive Chinese film ever made.
And then on top of that, there's more weapons in Hero than there may have been in the 70s. Right. But that being said, it's still just high-intensity fight scenes. It's Eastern. I mean, the whole film is based around separatist China before the wall was even built.
Sure.
Before the year zero. Yeah. This is China when there was still the Six Kingdoms.
Yeah. Well, there's a few elements that seem to be the most prevalent in the growth of this as a new genre. All of the new elements seem to concentrate on the things that worked in older kung fu films, which I mean, they were about action, but action at the end of the day is just a visual fest.
Sure.
You're watching a performance. Mm-hmm. So it's about visual.
Right.
It's about what's carried out visually in the film. And so Hiro seems to realize that and ask, what other visuals can we give you incorporated in the fights and beyond the fights?
Well, one thing that Hiro brings in, it's not going to say it's new to Hiro. It's been done before.
Sure.
But one thing that Hiro uses extensively, especially during the fight scenes, are a lot of wire stuff.
Right.
There's a lot of, I'm going to call it suspended gravity motion.
All right.
Because that's, I mean, that's literally what it is. Mm-hmm. But also that's a lot of how the movement works. It's a lot of extra high jumping, extra slow falling. It brings a slightly more glorious and tactful effect to every battle. It makes the individual fight scenes, since they're so heavy within the story of the film, every individual duel is so important to what's going on.
For sure.
It gives it a little bit more art. It makes it a little bit more heady.
Yeah.
For a battle.
Yeah.
It puts more thought into something that would otherwise just be a show of brute strength or maybe agility.
Yeah, the duels tell a story.
Right. So, I mean, I've seen it before. I've seen the suspended gravity effect before.
Sure.
But this is the first time that you've probably seen, you know, trailers, whatever. But this is the first time that you've really been exposed to it in an artistic sense, right?
True statement.
Did you hate it?
All right, so let me give you my take on this. And let me preface it with, who gives a shit about what I think. The first time I see this, it's abrasive because it's not an effect I've seen before. They're astronauts, right? They're floating through space. They're floating through the frame. But as the film goes on, I really begin to love these scenes. First of all, it cheats a little bit because it's a movie about legend. So right away, I'm okay if characters are flying around and walking across water. None of that bothers me. We're talking about a story that's retold over and over from different perspectives and given new information. So the fact that the battles are very fantastical doesn't bother me in the slightest. Especially after the first retelling, where you start to think, all right, these retellings are not necessarily to be believed, so we can embellish a little bit. But I don't think it would even really bother me out of that context. All right, so here's the thing. It's not safe. It's not a thing that is going to fall within everyone's suspension of disbelief. Not everyone is going to love wire fights. Not everyone is going to love the genre. But what I like about it is that it does not give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
It does not care what you think. It's not going anywhere is the point. They are going to use wires. They let you know in the beginning that they're going to fly around the whole film like fucking Superman, and you cannot do anything to stop it. So you can make a decision. You can say, all right, this is a film about astronaut martial artists, and you can go with that, or you can cross your arms and pout. The film doesn't care what you do. It's going to continue to use the wires. You are not going to convince this genre to stop shooting the most iconic element of what the genre has. It's fucking high-flying action, right?
I mean,
how are you going to get around that? At the end of the day, I think movies are about escapism. So you do something crazy, and you tell your audience to get over it. You do something because you can, and people like to see that. And after enough of it, I think people get used to it. And if they don't get used to it, fuck you. You can watch two people sit around in a room and talk. And if that's the kind of movie you want, that's fine. I want to see Chinese people fly around. I'm into that.
Yeah, well, plus it helps with the art form.
Yeah.
It helps with the look of the film. It helps
set
characters in the frame. Every fucking shot in this film is just a moving photograph.
You just have to believe that they can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Once you make that decision, once you are dedicated to that, it no longer bothers you. You can focus in on what they've created as a mechanic to tell you a story.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're not there. And that, you know, you play by the rules or you don't play the game. That's it.
So aside from the wires and the high flying action, as you put it, so let's just
do like my very American lowbrow high flying action.
So let's take a step back from what other people may consider the defining point of Kung Fu, which is the battles.
Yeah.
So there are battles between two individuals throughout the film. Almost every two people fight everybody else in this film.
Sure.
It's just a series of duels going on that eventually end up telling the story to why our character Nameless is finally facing this king.
Yeah.
There's also a couple really cool battle scenes that are almost beyond battle because of how artistic they look.
Sure.
Specifically, the one that I'm thinking of is when the Qin army starts barraging the calligraphy hut with arrows.
It's the calligraphy hut. I like that. Yeah, it's an assault, really.
The whole place is just raining with arrows. And for me, I mean, you can attest to this because you watched it sitting right next to me. But every time they release a volley of arrows, I just gasp.
Because Michael Kester loves his flying arrows.
The amount of arrows I can just imagine the type of, because the shot is set up in such a way that you don't even see the full army.
Right.
And yet the sky is gray with these arrows that are flying toward a bunch of unarmed, innocent people.
Well, it tells you a lot about that suspension of disbelief again. None of the arrows hit our main characters. They just go right back to work as usual. They talk to each other and eventually they fend off their, what was it? Calligraphy hut? Very nice. From the arrows using sword dance. Again, the film saying, you just have to buy this. We're retelling a story. You have to go along with that. If the characters all got shot up with arrows in the story, this wouldn't be the same story that I was telling you.
Well, a lot of that goes back to the mystic element of, sure, of the Old East. You know, this is BC that this is going on. This is in a time where for Western culture, there's beyond mysticism going on. There's barely even a Western culture to speak of.
Sure, sure.
It's before even alchemy. It's before the things that we make fun of on
pre-alchemy,
this show.
Pre-alchemy, yeah.
This is in
before
a time...
Before Sylvia Brown, before 9/11 conspiracies.
Absolutely. It's just way back in a time where, you know, this is over 2,000 years ago when people of legend probably believed really heavily in these elements of sword fighting and the honor that comes with it and the methods of learning to use their sword. They talk a lot about how calligraphy teaches you sword fighting.
Yeah, right.
That's another good aspect of the film is paralleling the art of calligraphy with the defensive style of sword fighting. That's really a motif for the whole film, is sure, art versus battle.
Well, and I talked before about storytelling through battles. Let me just expand on that real quick. One of the most obvious scenes is where Flying Snow is fighting with Moon, with Broken Sword's apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only scene where these two are fighting. And you can tell a lot about their characters, about what's happened previously, and about what's going to happen just by that battle. You know right away that they aren't on equal playing ground. They're different classes, first of all. But you can see just in the way they carry themselves, one is a warrior, and the other is an apprentice.
A calligraphist's apprentice.
Yeah, right, right. So Moon, the apprentice, is chasing Flying Snow, and Flying Snow is careless. She is without any concern for what is going to happen. She is taking a brisk stroll through, it's almost interpretive dance at this point.
Sure.
You know, she is frolicking through the fucking forest, and Moon is chasing her with every ounce of everything she has. And when they finally meet up to fight, really when things are on Flying Snow's terms, when she decides that, okay, I'll have a fight with you, she just dominates.
Yeah.
Her. It's effortless for her. And I think that tells you a lot about those two characters without any dialogue, without really any context. The two are fighting each other and you can pick up so much from that. And that happens really with each battle. Each battle throughout the film, we could do a whole episode on these fucking battles because they all tell you something different.
Well, another thing that's really interesting about the film, this again goes into kind of the art scheme and the overall gorgeous look of the film, is that depending on who's telling the story, and I can't comment on the actual significance of this because I don't really know, but every time the story is told, the characters are wearing a different color robe and the overall color scheme of the film changes. For example, so the whole film is based on an unreliable narrator, which is nameless. In the very beginning, he lies flat out to the king, telling him the story about how he has slain, through both trickery and skill, these three assassins. Turns out the king knows better than him, tells him the real story, and then nameless puts one more over on him because even he knows better than the king a second time. But the first time they go through the story, everyone is wearing red or different shades of red.
Mm-hmm.
They fight in that orange forest. The calligraphy hut is all red draped.
Yeah.
And then the king tells the story. Everybody's decked in blue. Everything's colder. Everything's softer. There's the battle between Flying Snow and Nameless in between that blue desert field with all the soldiers with their dark purple shields. Yeah. And then again, the story gets retold and everybody's wearing white. When Broken Sword is telling the flashback, everybody's wearing green and they're all in the green lake with the forest.
Right.
There's a lot of color that goes on just depending on the narrator, depending on where things stand as far as the actual truth is going. And when things are at their peak of sincerity, that's when everybody's decked out in white.
Well, I think you can find symbolism in the different colors. This has never been a very symbolic podcast, so I won't get on the rebirth of green.
Right.
Or, you know, the
violence
different,
of red.
Yeah, the different color schemes. But one thing it does serve to do is differentiate the various stories. You know, and you mentioned the hut. You know it's the same hut, but you see that the color schemes are different. So you know these are almost incompatible stories. I mean, you kind of know that from the plot of the film. but that serves to let you know immediately, visually. Things aren't red anymore. Things are blue. Things aren't blue anymore. Things are white. So these aren't stories that happen simultaneously. We're not telling a nonlinear, broken up story. We're telling different stories, different ways things could have gone or the way that things right. actually went. And what the colors, I think, serve to do beyond the symbolism is keep all those things very separate in your mind. So you know exactly what was happening. And then you can think back on the red story and you can say, why did he tell those lies? What purpose did that story serve? When the king was telling the blue story, how was that different from the original story? And how did those details, very important details, differ in the final telling of the story? Sure. I think it just keeps all those things separate.
Right. And then once you get through all the stories, depending on your color of choice, you end up in the black story,
mm-hmm.
which is where it is just nameless, 10 paces away from the king. Right. And you have spent the entire film trying to figure out how he got there and why he's there. And you realize that he is there to kill the king,
yeah.
and that he has put one over. Everyone has survived with the exception of Sky. Sky gave his life for this cause.
Yeah.
Everybody else is alive. And Nameless is there to kill the king. It is what he's been there, what he's been raised and trained to do for 10 years. And he doesn't do it.
All right. So there's a lot to be said about this, but there's a lot to be said about this film in general. And there was a lot to be said about Black Dynamite. So I'm going to give you my very concise perspective on this.
All right.
It's a really broad and expansive statement that is made about the community and how he eventually feels about his objective with the king here. But at the end of the day, he comes up to him, right behind him, shows him that he could have easily killed him, just in case there's any doubt, which I don't think there was.
Right.
But he's standing right there. And what he does is give the king a second chance.
Right.
Letting you know how, and the audience probably wants it at that point
right.
too.
Well, and this, of course, comes after the king has almost, without begging, has explained to him that a true swordsman is without need for his sword.
Sure,
a true swordsman has realized that you don't need a sword and that peace is the best way of a swordsman. He's talking about the multiple steps of learning swordsmanship.
Sure,
and
sure.
The ultimate realization is that you need a sword at all.
Well, the entire purpose of retelling these tales, explaining all of this to the king, is to teach him a lesson.
Right.
You know, the king doesn't understand the relationship between calligraphy and swordsmanship any more than the average viewer would
mm-hmm.
upon watching the film for the first time. So this whole thing is a lesson for him. And when he comes up behind him with this sword and chooses not to kill him, he's saying a lot of things, but what he's really pointing out for me is how senseless death is, how needless it
right.
is. He says to him, I'm giving you this second chance. You can do this thing without the sword.
So essentially what he's doing is he's throwing his sword down in hopes that the king will actually
sure, yeah.
unify China and that the king's mission is actually a benevolent one, despite maybe some tyrannical rule and some genocide along the way.
Right.
Ends justify the means in a dark sense. But he hopes that the king will unify China. That is his hope. And he takes his leave. He drops the sword on the ground and he walks back to the gate. At which point, all of the king's soldiers begin asking,
yeah.
more demanding
yeah.
that he allow them to execute Nameless, to execute
yes.
the hero at
yeah.
this point. And the king, in a fantastic show of his own words, you want to finish this for me?
Caves to peer pressure? Is
apparently.
That, yeah. He slaughters our hero, which infuriates me, by the way, because he's given a second chance. This, to me, is not about unity. All right, so he's going to rule an empire. Of course he's going to unify everyone. It's not about the unity, but about the means to that unity. And he's decided to exercise force as the means to that unity. And I think that's what he says when he slaughters our main character.
Exactly.
Needlessly fucking slaughters our main character. The king learned nothing.
And essentially he ends up winning anyway.
What a dick.
Bullshit.
I like how you brought it back down there. Very nice.
Yeah, totally.
Doublefeatureshow.com is our website. If you could leave us a review on iTunes, we would really, really like that. Not a star review. That's nice too, but type something in the little box and send it to us. That'd be really, really great. If you prefer not to use the public form, you can also send us an email. That's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. But thanks to everyone's donations, we finally replaced our input box. You are now hearing the smooth sounds of the new PreSonus Fire Studio. In addition to the usual show runners, we also got a donation from Nate this week, who will be playing the sideshow's cook. So finally, someone can provide chicken for Matt, who, by the way, I'm going to out him on the show here.
Mm-hmm.
Matt didn't understand the man-eating chicken gag.
Oh.
It was completely lost on him. People, the man-eating chicken is not actually a giant chicken. That's the joke. fuck it. I mentioned last episode, we are now on a campaign to buy advertising for this show. Now, we're apparently too explicit for actual radio syndication, but that's not going to change. I mean, we refuse to alter the show because it's our goddamn show. And if we want to spend 25 minutes blaspheming or talking about bloody genitalia, then that's just what we're going to do. Unfortunately, without getting on the air, there's only so much of an audience a podcast can attract without some serious funding. Usually corporate backing or... I mean, we're free market guys. Nothing wrong with sponsorship. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what we should do with the show. I mean, this isn't a radio show. This isn't traditional. It's a show that belongs to our listeners. They've funded everything so far, and I think as we look to expand, we should probably turn to them. So we have some great, bizarre double feature advertisements planned, but we have to pay money to put them out there. So if you think we deserve a chance to try them out, the URL is donate.doublefeatureshow.com. You and you alone get to determine how far this show will actually reach. So world domination aside, what are we doing next week?
Next time I'm going to have a bunch of people over to my place and we're going to try to gross them out.
All right. What's your plan of attack for that?
We're going to show a bunch of people inside and drag me to hell.
I'm already disgusted.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.